Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I don't know of any speaker that we have presented here since, certainly since I've been here, who has authored more books than H.W. Brands. Bill Brands, I counted this morning, and there are 20 books that he has personally authored. And they cover a wide range of topics. He says he's never been able to really concentrate on anything, but seems like he's been able to concentrate effectively at a very productive level on many things. Bill Brands was educated at Stanford University, where he got his bachelor's degree in history, at Reed College for a master's, at Portland State University for another master's, and his PhD is from the University of Texas. He now teaches, has a chair as professor of history, and he's also professor of government at the University of Texas. It's a great pleasure to welcome Bill Brands.
Thank you. Thank you, George, and thank you all for coming. I'm delighted to have an audience like this morning. If I weren't lecturing to you, I'd be lecturing to my students in Austin. And although I flatter myself that I'm a reasonably interesting teacher, I know that they all have ulterior motives in coming, that the stuff is going to be on the test or they're going to be responsible for it in some other way. I know you're not, and I know you could be doing something else, so I take that as at least an advance approval. So I'm going to talk today about, well, not exactly about my book on Andrew Jackson, but more precisely why I wrote a book about Andrew Jackson. And this is in lieu of the preface that isn't in the book. About 10 years ago, I stopped writing prefaces to books. I did this for a couple of reasons. One is that I always found prefaces kind of annoying. They seemed to get in front of the story, and I wanted to jump right to the story. But when I did, I always felt that I was missing something, as I certainly was. And another reason for this is that I teach at the University of Texas, and I teach students from the freshman level to the graduate level. And one of the things that I have to impress upon my graduate students is that they have to exercise a certain, time effectiveness in doing their reading. Many of them come to a graduate program in history with a naive assumption that this will be a great place to read history books. And I disabuse them of that idea fairly quickly because there's simply too many history books to read. They have to learn how to figure out what's in the history books without actually reading the books. There's not time. And so I remind them of something that was impressed upon me when I published my first book. It was a book that was published by Columbia University Press, and William Luchtenberg was the editor of the series in which it was published. And he explained something that I should have figured out myself through my graduate education, but he said that it's much more important that you write a good preface than that you write a good book. Because especially if a book is published by a university press and you expect to have the normal kind of academic audience, the odds are that they will, if they have to choose, they'll read the preface rather than the book itself. And there are reasons for this, and the reasons have to do with the fact that academics are overloaded with, he said, imagine the person who's going to be reviewing this book. It'll be somebody who's given 500 words in the American Historical Review. And this person has a stack of blue books to grade. And various term papers and dissertations to read and committee assignments to do. And he's going to be juggling all of this stuff, and the only way that you can guarantee that he's going to get your point is if you put it in those first three pages. If you bury it in the 350 pages of the book, he might not get it. So I took this lesson, and for the next 10 years I wrote these prefaces. But I finally decided that that was sort of cheating because if I could say it in three pages, why did I bother writing the whole book? So I stopped doing it. And for about the last 10 years, I haven't been writing prefaces. Sometimes I wish I had. Sometimes I was glad I hadn't. Since this book came out, it's been reviewed in a number of places. And I'm surprised at the number of reviewers who have missed the point of the book. Now, if I had taken time to write the preface and nail down exactly what I was saying, then presumably they would have gotten the point. It can be a blessing, however, when reviewers miss the point of the book. One of the best reviews I ever got, the most useful review I ever got, was one that was written by Paul Johnson for a review of a biography I did of Theodore Roosevelt. Now, Paul Johnson apparently really liked Theodore Roosevelt, and he read enough of my book to infer that I at least kind of liked Theodore Roosevelt too. So he concluded that it must be a really good book. From the nature of the review, I could tell he didn't read it. However, he did give me the best one-line endorsement I've ever had. He said, "Every red-blooded American should read this book." Well, you can imagine what sentence I extracted and now is it blazoned at the top of the paperback edition. Anyway, I'm going to provide for you the preface that's not in the book. And in prefaces, authors generally explain why they wrote the book and sort of what the major points or themes of the book are. The reason I wrote a book about Andrew Jackson was that I was faced with something of a historical and political puzzle. I knew enough history. I'd been teaching American history for 25 years. Every year I teach a large lecture, a survey of American history. Sometimes I teach the first half of the American history course that goes from the colonial period up through the Civil War, and sometimes I teach the second half of the course. And I knew enough about American history to have gathered that Andrew Jackson had an enormous reputation during his time. Andrew Jackson, well, of all of the standard classifications, all of the normally labeled eras of American history, the colonial era, the revolutionary era, the Civil War era, Reconstruction, Progressive era, the New Deal, Cold War, there's only one that's named for an individual, and that's the Jacksonian era. Okay? There's a reason for that, which I will explain. I also knew enough about the history to know that Andrew Jackson was considered to be the second George Washington. The first George Washington had won independence for the United States. The second George Washington, Andrew Jackson, had confirmed independence. I knew that for the period after the Battle of New Orleans, which was his initial claim to great fame, that he was commonly known simply as the hero. It required no additional modification. It was just the hero. So that these days, or the last 30 or years, if you have any interest in popular music in this country and somebody refers to the king, it's Elvis Presley. Well, Andrew Jackson was, in certain respects, the Elvis Presley of his day. I was trying to quantify Andrew Jackson's popularity. I couldn't refer to public opinion polls because there weren't any during that period. I could have tried to go through newspaper editorials, and that might have gotten me partway there, but one of the problems of dealing with 19th century newspapers is that they made no pretense, most of them made no pretense toward objectivity. And they were, in many cases, simply party organs. So they would be strictly party line. And it would be hard to tell, it's also hard to tell whether they bothered to reflect the views of their readers. So I came up with what struck me as a really rough and ready metric for assessing the popularity of important figures. Now you can decide for yourself whether it holds any water at all. But what I did was I went to an atlas of American history and I turned to the index, the back, and I just looked at all the places named for Andrew Jackson. So the Jackson counties, the Jacksonvilles, the Jackson cities, the Jackson this, and I compared it with places named for other individuals. I had already known that there were a whole lot of places named for Benjamin Franklin. Well, partly because I wrote a book about Benjamin Franklin. But I decided to see how Jackson stacked. I assumed that there were a bunch of places named for George Washington and a fair number of Jeffersons and Jefferson cities and the like. Well, it turns out that there are more places named for Andrew Jackson than for anybody else. This despite the fact that certainly Washington and Jefferson and Franklin had about 50 years head start on Jackson. So, anyway, I knew that Jackson had this very large contemporary reputation. And it doesn't push the point too far, I think, to say that Jackson was generally considered to be the towering figure of American politics, certainly between Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln. And there are large parts of the South where I don't have to stop at Abraham Lincoln, where Jackson goes right on through till the 20th century. Okay, that's how Jackson was viewed in his time. Now, I know that Jackson is not viewed that way today. What do people today know about Andrew Jackson? Well, most people know that he's that fellow on the $20 bill who's having one of the great hair days in American history. Some people connect him to the idea of democracy, but what most people know about Andrew Jackson, what people learn in schools today about Andrew Jackson, is generally the negative side of his reputation. And I can fairly specifically identify this period of the fall in Andrew Jackson's reputation. And again, this is just a personal experience. You decide what it's worth. I grew up in Portland, Oregon. And in Portland, the high schools are all named for American presidents. So there's a Washington High, Jefferson High, Lincoln High, Roosevelt High, and so on. In the early 1960s, the city had grown and a new high school was required in the southwestern part of the city. And it was established in about sometime between 1960 and 1966 or 67. I don't remember the exact year. And it was named for Andrew Jackson. And Jackson High, it seemed to be an utterly unremarkable event to name a high school for Andrew Jackson. Now, Portland is one of the most liberal cities in this country. It is as deep blue as they get. And I can guarantee you that if a new high school were built in Portland today, it would not be named for Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson labors under this cloud. And the cloud, I suppose, can be boiled down into an indictment of, call it an indictment of Jackson on three counts. In the first place, Andrew Jackson was a slaveholder. Now, by itself, slaveholding doesn't disqualify someone from historical greatness, but if you are going to be a slaveholder and you want to have a good reputation today, you have to be in some measure, well, I won't mince words here, you have to be a hypocrite about it. You have to be someone like George Washington, who was a slaveholder, but knew it was wrong and freed his slaves upon Martha's death. Or you could be someone like Thomas Jefferson, who owned twice as many slaves as Andrew Jackson ever did, but quite clearly agonized about it. Did he do anything about it? No, but at least he agonized about it. And so he gives our modern sensibility something to work with. We know that Jefferson was struggling with this. Andrew Jackson never gave any impression of struggling with the morality of slavery. Andrew Jackson was a slaveholder. He believed that slavery was a necessary evil. It was a part of his world. Unlike Jefferson, Andrew Jackson didn't spend a lot of time worrying about a better world in the future. He didn't have time. He couldn't sit on his porch at Monticello and look out and imagine that things would be better. For Andrew Jackson was very much a man of his times. And he was a man for whom his times were a constant struggle. He didn't have the freedom to philosophize. He had to deal with the world as it was. So, one strike against Andrew Jackson, a slaveholder who apparently didn't know any better. I will add, though, that Andrew Jackson never became an apologist for slavery, as some of his close contemporaries did. He never followed John Calhoun, for example, in developing a positive ideology of slavery. For Jackson, slavery was part of the world. It was a necessary evil, just like war was a necessary evil. Andrew Jackson didn't glorify war, but that's the way his world worked. The second count against Andrew Jackson is that he was a militant expansionist. Andrew Jackson almost single-handedly wrested Florida from Spain and added it to the American Union. In doing so, Andrew Jackson pioneered the principle or the call it the political military strategy of plausible deniability. Andrew Jackson was general of the army, major general of the army, responsible for the defense of the southern border of the United States, which at that time, this is in the late 1810s, consisted of the border between the southern part of Mississippi Territory and Spanish Florida. Florida was nominally controlled by Spain, but in practice it wasn't controlled by anybody. Florida became a haven for outlaws, for pirates, for British agents, for runaway slaves, for various kinds of malcontents who were intent on trouble against the border that Jackson was pledged to defend. Jackson told President Monroe that if he would simply give the nod, if Monroe would simply give the nod, Jackson could clean up the Florida mess within 6 weeks. And Jackson, would take responsibility for it if it became controversial. Exactly what Monroe said in reply has been a source of controversy ever since. Jackson said that he got the nod from Monroe, and therefore he went ahead. Monroe claimed after the fact that he had given no such approval. I guess he was really carrying the plausible deniability right to the end. But the result was that Jackson defeated the Spanish in Florida, forced Spain's hand in negotiations with John Quincy Adams, then Secretary of State, by which Florida was ceded to the United States. Later in his life, Jackson sent Sam Houston, his Tennessee protege, to Texas, at the time when Texas was part of Mexico. Houston was Jackson's secret agent. Houston's design was to foment unrest among the Americans living in Texas, who then proceeded to rebel against Mexico, declaring an independent Texas in essentially the last act of his life. Jackson collaborated with Houston to ensure that Texas be annexed to the United States, which event very quickly gave rise to the war between the United States and Mexico of 1846 to 1848, which by nearly any standard was the most nakedly aggressive war in American history. And this is definitely a legacy of Andrew Jackson. It's one of the things that made this country what it is today, but it's also part of our history that we're not too comfortable with. Just as we're not particularly comfortable with slavery, and we don't want to be reminded of it, likewise, we're not comfortable with the idea that this country was built through aggressive expansion against the neighbors. And Andrew Jackson reminds us of that. And so this is strike two against Jackson. The third count in the indictment, and this is the one that school children seem to learn before they learn anything else about Andrew Jackson, is that Andrew Jackson was the author of the Trail of Tears, the forced eviction of the Cherokees from Georgia on a route that in 1838 led to the deaths of as many as 4,000 out of perhaps 15 or 16,000 who were forced out of Georgia. And this is the commonest thing I hear against Jackson. And I'm surprised, actually, at the vehemence with which this particular opinion is voiced. I was, just before my book has been out, just about a month. Before it came out, the publishers these days, produced something that's called an advanced reader's copy, which is essentially the manuscript bound in paperback book form with a cover that looks like the cover of a paperback. And it's given out in large numbers to booksellers for free. I attended a convention of booksellers. This one happened to be in Seattle, I guess. And I was, the booksellers get these free, and when you go to these conventions, you can sign them. They can get the copy signed. Well, at this particular convention, I was sitting there with a table, a stack of these advanced reader's copies, and there was a line that was forming, and most of the booksellers came up, and they wanted their copies signed. And this one gentleman stood in line patiently for 10 or 15 minutes as the line moved forward. And when he got up to the head of the line, I pulled down one of these copies, and I said, okay, how can I personalize this for you? He said, I don't want it. Oh, okay. So he leaned forward, and he looked at me with this very stern look. He just glowered at me, and he said, I hope you don't admire Andrew Jackson. And I didn't know what to say, because I've written a book about the guy. I developed a certain sympathy for him, and I hope a certain understanding of him. And besides, I wrote this book, I want to sell some copies. And so, I got to take the side of my guy. So, very diplomatically, I said, well, I admire Andrew Jackson's admirable qualities. Well, he wasn't happy at all, and he turned on his heel and left in a huff. Well, since the book has come out, I've been on various radio shows, and some of them are the call-in kind. And I have to say that just about every time I'm on one of these shows, somebody will call in, either early or late. It's late if they're expecting somebody else to ask the question. But it's one of these questions that, again, takes the form not so much of a question as of an accusation. And the accusation usually, well, one caller put it this way: how can you defend that genocidal maniac? Okay. Well, I quickly say, I'll tell you, that in the book, I don't defend Andrew Jackson. I really have no particular, I don't care one way or the other, whether if you read my book, you end up liking Andrew Jackson or not. That's beside the point. And nowhere in the book do I render judgment on Andrew Jackson, which is kind of frustrating to those reviewers as well. They don't get a preface, and they don't get a thumbs up or a thumbs down at the end. So they have to read the darn thing to figure out what exactly I'm saying. But when I do try to explain Andrew Jackson's Indian policy, it goes something like this. In the first place, Andrew Jackson wasn't president when the Trail of Tears took place. It was his successor, Martin Van Buren. However, it's certainly true that Andrew Jackson's policy was based on the underlying philosophy of Indian removal. Andrew Jackson had sponsored the 1830 Indian Removal Act, whose entire premise was this, that the Indian tribes and whites could not live in close proximity without one side killing the other or vice versa. Everything in Jackson's experience had led him to believe that this was simply the way the world worked. Might the world have worked differently? Maybe, but nothing in Jackson's experience led him to believe that that could be so. So Jackson's policy from the moment he entered the White House in 1829, starting in his first annual message in December 1829, that day's equivalent of State of the Union messages, was that the Indian tribes, the few Indian tribes that remained east of the Mississippi River, must move to the west of the Mississippi River. They had to go beyond the pale of the states into the unorganized territories. In part, this reflected Jackson's respect, indeed almost reverence, for states' rights. Now, I'm going to say something in a few minutes that's going to suggest that Jackson's view of states' rights wasn't the same as, say, Robert E. Lee's view of states' rights, or, for that matter, John Calhoun's view of states' rights. Jackson, however, did believe in states' rights in terms of the most appropriate legislation. Jackson was a narrow constructionist. Jackson believed that the federal government ought to be small and that what governing took place ought to be, for the most part, done by the states. His construction of the Constitution was so narrow that in 1832, when a cholera epidemic swept through the United States and a group of ministers came to the White House imploring the president to declare a national day of prayer, he declined. Not that he had anything against prayer, not that he didn't think that praying might have some beneficial effect, some alleviating effect on the epidemic, but simply because in his reading of the Constitution, he saw nothing in there that authorized the president to declare a national day of prayer. Now, a national day of prayer is fairly innocuous and uncontroversial, and it certainly would have been for Jackson. And he could have scored political points by declaring that day of prayer. There were enough people out there who thought that he was a godless heathen that it would have helped his reputation a little bit. But he didn't. He said, if you want a day of prayer, go talk to your governors. Go talk to your state legislatures. They're the appropriate person to declare such a day of prayer. Anyway, part of Jackson's Indian policy was based on respect for the rights of the states. The celebrated Indian case was the Cherokees versus Georgia. And Jackson took the position, well, first of all, he took the position that the Cherokees could stay in Georgia if they wanted to, but only if they agreed to abide by the laws of the state of Georgia. What the Cherokees wanted was to live under their own laws, to live as a separate nation within the state of Georgia. And Jackson's interpretation of states' rights wouldn't allow that. Beyond that, and this is the thing that really makes Jackson seem to be the lightning rod on this subject, the Supreme Court decided in favor of the Cherokees in a case where the Cherokees took on the state of Georgia to determine whether they had to abide by the laws of the state of Georgia. And the Supreme Court sided with the Cherokees. And the opinion of the court was written by Chief Justice John Marshall. And Andrew Jackson is supposed to have said, now I don't think he really said it, but it did reflect his view. He's supposed to have said, Chief Justice Marshall has rendered his opinion. Now let him enforce it. To our ears, this sounds like a president who simply refuses to accept the supremacy of the Supreme Court. To our ears, that's what it sounds like. And that's exactly what it was. However, to our ears, that sounds like usurpation on the part of the president. That sounds like a president who's out of control. But in fact, in Jackson's day, that philosophy was relatively uncontroversial. We live in an age of, well, essentially utter acceptance of the idea of judicial review, of judicial supremacy, that when the Supreme Court speaks, that ends all debate. In fact, that's why everyone is so worked up over who's going to be the successor to Sandra Day O'Connor, because the Supreme Court is considered really supreme in Jackson's day. It was considered the supreme among the courts, but Jackson and many other Jacksonians, and not just Jacksonians, believed that the Supreme Court did not bind, did not speak for the executive branch or the legislative branch. It spoke for the judicial branch. This was Jackson's philosophy, which was articulated very clearly in a fight he had over the constitutionality of the Bank of the United States. But in any event, when Jackson said this, it wasn't defiance exactly of the Supreme Court. At least it wasn't defiance of a commonly accepted principle. It was simply an articulation of a philosophy of governance that we've abandoned. And Jackson wasn't alone. Abraham Lincoln played as fast and loose with the Constitution and Supreme Court rulings as Andrew Jackson did. But the final reason, the final justification in Jackson's mind, or justification, the final reason for Jackson's Indian policy was simply that if the Cherokees insisted on remaining in Georgia, they would all be killed. Now, Jackson, I mean, he wasn't saying, I'm going to kill them. What he was saying is, their neighbors are going to kill them. Jackson pointed to, well, the names of a score of tribes that had lived in New England, that had lived in New York, that had lived in Pennsylvania, and that simply by the 1830s had vanished. They had all died. Some of them by, many of them by disease, others at the hands of whites. Jackson understood what the mentality of the Georgia frontiersman was because he had spent his life among them, among frontiersmen, not specifically in Georgia. And he understood that the alternatives were two. One, you can move, or two, you can stay where you are and you will die. This was, if Jackson had had a mind to defend the Cherokees in Georgia, and sometimes it's suggested that what Jackson should have done was the equivalent of what Dwight Eisenhower did in 1957 when the governor of Arkansas refused to enforce the Supreme Court's decision mandating desegregation of schools. And Eisenhower, what did he do? He sent in the 101st Airborne to enforce the Supreme Court's decision. This wasn't an option for Jackson. There was no 101st Airborne. There was no army to speak of. In the 1830s, the United States still operated under the principle that armies are for wartime. And when the country's not at war, you disband the army and send them home. If Jackson had had a mind to enforce that order of the Supreme Court, which, by the way, said nothing to Andrew Jackson. It was directed at the state of Georgia. It didn't order the president of the United States to do anything at all. If Jackson had had a mind to defend the Cherokees in Georgia, it would have required, first of all, going to Congress and asking for authorizations and appropriations to raise an army. There weren't but a handful of votes in Congress to support that. The fact of the matter is that Andrew Jackson's Indian policy was very much the Indian policy of the United States. And Indian policy of the United States had dated back to the time before there was a United States and continued until after the Civil War. Andrew Jackson took a high profile in this, and he's the one who gets blamed for a lot of it. But if it hadn't been Andrew Jackson as president, any other president would have done essentially the same thing. Perhaps not have stated it quite so provocatively, but would have followed the same policy because every president before and after him until Ulysses Grant did. Anyway, I've laid out the indictment against Andrew Jackson. I haven't told you why Andrew Jackson was considered so important during his day. And if I had written a preface to the book, the preface would identify the major themes of the book so that you would be on the lookout for these themes as you read through the body of the book. There were two things that made Andrew Jackson the hero of his time, and two things that made him the great figure for certainly populist-minded, ordinary Americans. The first was that Andrew Jackson essentially single-handedly saved the Union, not once, but twice, on the battlefield and again from the presidency. Andrew Jackson first saved the Union at the Battle of New Orleans in 1815. As a teacher of American history, as a co-author of a textbook on American history, I can tell you with some confidence that the War of 1812 is these days considered something of a footnote to American history. It began for causes that had vanished by the time the war ended, and it ended with an appeal simply to the status quo ante bellum. Let's just forget we ever fought this war. It was a war in which the American side definitely did not cover itself in glory, with the exception of Andrew Jackson, sort of William Henry Harrison. And if the War of 1812 is a footnote to history, the Battle of New Orleans is something of a footnote to the footnote. Reminds me of law review articles, where you actually do get footnotes to footnotes. But anyway, and it was a footnote to history because, as any clever fifth grader learns, the battle was fought after the war was over. Now, that in itself is a bit of an oxymoron, because if it's a battle, the war's not over yet. But what they mean is that the treaty to end the war had been signed in Europe, the town of Ghent, what's now Belgium, on December 24th, Christmas Eve, 1814. And the Battle of New Orleans was not fought until January 8th, 1815. So it didn't have any effect on the outcome of the war. That's the conclusion that we draw. And that conclusion would be quite wrong. Because, in the first place, needless to say, nobody at New Orleans knew that a treaty had been signed. In the second place, as Woodrow Wilson, whose portrait I just saw in the office out front, learned to his dismay, a treaty is not a treaty until it's ratified. You can sign a wonderful treaty, but if the Senate or if the counterpart in the foreign country doesn't ratify it, it's not a treaty. The Treaty of Ghent was utterly unratified at the time the battle was fought. And I would contend it wouldn't have been ratified, certainly not by the British, if the battle had turned out differently. What the British intended at New Orleans was nothing less than the dismembering of the United States. The British Southern Offensive, this was an offensive that combined the forces that had captured Washington, D.C. the previous summer, had burned the White House and the Capitol, combined those forces with the forces from Europe that had just defeated Napoleon, Wellington's Invincibles, they were called. This was the best army in Europe. They were transported across the Atlantic to gang up on Andrew Jackson at New Orleans. The point of the British attack on New Orleans was to burst past New Orleans, to drive up the Mississippi River, to connect with a second British army coming down the Mississippi from the lakes, from Canada, and therefore splitting the United States in two, peeling away the Louisiana Territory and all of the West, and either giving that back to Britain's ally, Spain, or handing it over to friendly Indian tribes who would forever contain American expansion to the West. This at a moment when Federalists in New England were grumbling about the policies of the Madison administration and talking almost openly about seceding from the Union in favor of a pro-British New England republic. So Jackson understood, everybody at the time understood, that the fate of the United States hung in the balance. And after all the defeats that the Americans had suffered at British hands, and after the reinforcement of British troops from Europe, nearly everybody expected that the British would prevail at New Orleans, that there was nothing that was going to stop the British from moving up the Mississippi River. The only person who believed that the British could be stopped was Andrew Jackson. He believed that they must be stopped, and therefore they could be stopped. The army that Jackson had at New Orleans to defend against the British was one of the most ragtag outfits in American history. It consisted of a handful of army regulars, a bunch of militiamen from various states, including Jackson's home state of Tennessee. It was during the War of 1812 that Tennessee acquired the nickname the Volunteers for the alacrity with which Tennesseans responded to Jackson's call for volunteers. Jackson's army at New Orleans included as well French nationals and Spanish nationals who still hadn't recovered from the fact that against their will, they had become part of the United States. In fact, many of the French, and especially the Spanish, were actively hoping for an American defeat so that New Orleans once again would become Spanish. They wouldn't have to deal with those insufferable Americans. But the Spanish and the French decided, after some rather stern measures by Andrew Jackson, that they had more to fear from Jackson than they did from the British. And so they decided to fight. Jackson's army consisted as well of free African Americans, of slaves dragooned into support of the army, of members of several Indian tribes. Now, this is something that's worth noting. And it's worth noting just in its general application to American history. We often think in terms of whites against Indians. There was not a single important battle between, let's say, whites and Indians in American history, certainly before the Civil War, in which the white side, the Anglo-American side, did not have substantial Indian allies. It was as much Indians against Indians as it was whites against Indians. And in all of Andrew Jackson's victories over Indians, Andrew Jackson was the great Indian fighter of his time. In every one of his victories, he had Indian allies. Okay, so there were Indians fighting for Jackson at New Orleans. There were 800 Haitians. I still haven't figured out exactly what they were doing there. There were the pirates under Jean Lafitte. So there was this motley group of fighters, soldiers, of wannabes, who became convinced by Andrew Jackson that they could win. Andrew Jackson was not a terrific strategist. He didn't have to be, although he did reasonably well in getting his forces to the place they had to be at the time they had to be there. He was a good tactician, but more than anything, he was an absolutely irresistible leader of men. And Jackson bent this army to his will, convinced them that when those British troops marched out of the fog, the British troops wore the red coats for a reason. They didn't want to hide. They wanted to be seen. They wanted the enemy to see them coming from a long way off. The whole strategy was to strike terror into the hearts of the defenders. And on that morning, at dawn on January 8, 1815, they marched out of the fog on the plain of Chalmette outside of New Orleans. And they marched forward and they marched forward. And the American side would fire and some of the British would fall down. And as soon as one British soldier went down, another soldier would take his place. And they kept coming and they kept coming. And as they got close, they lowered their bayonets. And the idea was that as they kept coming and they kept coming, the nerve of the defenders would break, their lines would break, and they would run. Jackson gave them confidence, essentially let them know they had no choice but to stand and fight, and the Americans did. And the result was the most astonishing victory, perhaps, in American military history. Jackson's side took 2,000 British killed, captured, wounded, against less than 24 on Jackson's side. When the news reached Washington and New York and Boston about 3 weeks later, it seemed as though it was a stroke of divine deliverance. And Andrew Jackson was the agent of the Almighty come to save the United States. At that point, Jackson was almost immediately talked about as a candidate for president. So the first thing that Jackson was revered for was that he saved the Union at New Orleans. The second thing that Jackson was honored for, was respected for, was revered for, was that he was the advance agent of American democracy. I said just seconds ago that as of January 1815, people were talking about Andrew Jackson as a candidate for president, but it would be another 10 years before he had a realistic possibility, for the reason that in 1815, the United States was only about halfway in its evolution from a very restricted Republican form of government, small r, Republican form of government, to a mass-based democracy. Between 1787, when the Constitution was written, and 1824, when Jackson ran for president the first time, the basis for American politics changed enormously. The franchise was extended dramatically, so that by the 1820s, the word democracy applied accurately to American politics. Of course, democracy in the 1820s meant rather less than democracy does today. What it meant was essentially that if you were an adult white male, you could vote. If you didn't fit that description, you quite probably couldn't. If you were a woman, no. If you were African American, no. Did I leave anything else out there? No, that was basically, oh, well, if you're a kid, you couldn't, still can't. This is an interesting conversation I have with my students. Will there ever be a time when we expand democracy further and let children vote? I think they ought to be able to vote, at least from the age of 12, on anything touching high-tech or computer policy. For other issues, maybe not. But anyhow. So Jackson began being spoken of as a candidate for president, but only in the 1820s did he have a realistic chance, because only by the 1820s could ordinary people vote for president. You may or may not know that until the 1820s, the electors, the closest thing we have to the vote for president, were by and large chosen by the state legislatures, not by individuals in the states. And if you were paying close attention in the campaign of 2000, you may recall that that possibility is still quite alive. When the vote hung up in Florida, and the Floridians and everybody else couldn't quite figure out whether to recount, what to recount, how it was going to be done, there was talk of the Florida legislature stepping in and simply deciding who would get Florida's electoral votes. And some people went and looked at their constitution and discovered to their dismay that there is no constitutional right to vote for president, not even to vote for the presidential electors. The Constitution simply says that the states shall choose electors, and it's up to the states to decide how to do it. Until the 1820s, most states confined the vote to the legislatures. By the 1820s, it shifted in the other direction, just in time for Andrew Jackson, who was the first person who can be accurately described as a common man to run for president. Presidents before Jackson had been favored by birth, by wealth, by education, by something else that elevated them above the rest of the population, so that from the time of the American Revolution, American government could be government of the people, but by no stretch was it government by the people, certainly not at a national level. Presidents were expected to be somewhat above the rest. With Andrew Jackson, for the first time, a president chosen from the people themselves had a reasonable chance. Now, Andrew Jackson ran for president. Actually, he allowed himself to be drafted for president in 1824. And after a tough campaign, Jackson wound up with the most electoral votes and the most popular votes. But because it was a four-way race, he didn't have a majority. Therefore, the race went to the House of Representatives. And in the House of Representatives, the second-place finisher, John Quincy Adams, and the fourth-place finisher, Henry Clay of Kentucky, ganged up on Jackson, giving Adams the presidency and Clay the Secretaryship of State, at a time when being Secretary of State was the next best thing to being president, because it was the next thing before becoming president. The previous five presidents had apprenticed as Secretary of State. So it looked as though Adams said to Clay, "You make me president, and I'll make you the next president." The Jacksonians were outraged at this. The Jacksonians declared the Adams-Clay deal a corrupt bargain. Duels were fought over this issue. The Jacksonians immediately declared John Quincy Adams to be an illegitimate president. They went into opposition at once. Jackson, in the spring of 1825, was nominated for president in 1828. If you think campaigns are long today, it's nothing like then. It helped matters that there were no organized national conventions. Candidates were sometimes, at least in Jackson's case, were nominated by state legislatures. So the Tennessee legislature nominated Andrew Jackson for president in 1825 for the race of 1828. Now, I was researching this book, and I was thinking about this during the election campaign of 2000. And I was in the middle of 1824 when the contested election of 2000 took place. And when there was this dispute about the votes, when the Supreme Court stepped in and awarded the presidency to George W. Bush, the second place finisher in the popular vote, I fully expected, based on what I was immersed in regarding 1824, I fully expected the Democrats today, in 2000, to do essentially the same thing, to declare George W. Bush an illegitimate president, to announce that Al Gore immediately had the nomination for 2004, and to start campaigning right away. And the Democrats did no such thing, which made me, at that point, reflect on, well, what was the difference between 2000 and 1824? Well, part of it was, most of it was, that in the 1820s, Americans took politics much more seriously than we take politics today. Believe it or not, I mean, sometimes people think we get obsessed with politics. Nothing like in the 1820s. But here's why. It wasn't simply that there were giants who walked the earth in those days. No, it was that there was much more at stake. And this gets at the heart of Jackson's second contribution and the thing that he was so revered for during his time. And that is that in the 1820s, democracy was just emerging as the way that American politics were going to be conducted, but it hadn't yet been accepted. John Quincy Adams had serious reservations about the whole enterprise of democracy. His father was one who, it's John Adams, had spoken openly against democracy. John Quincy Adams, the son, was a little bit more discreet in the way he spoke, but he shared the view that democracy was the halfway house between honest, virtuous republicanism and anarchy or civil war. In fact, John Quincy Adams spent the last 20 years of his life forecasting the civil war that eventually did come. And so the Jacksonians had to declare John Quincy Adams illegitimate, and they had to start campaigning in 1828 because they had no guarantee that there would be an election of 1820, at least any election that would be fair. After all, Adams and his gang had stolen the election of 1824. What was to prevent them from stealing the election of 1828? They hadn't accepted the idea that the people should rule. They, in fact, had overturned the decision of the people. That's their interpretation on the 1824 election by the Jacksonians. And that was why they started campaigning right away and why they took things so seriously. By contrast, in 2000, nobody, not even the hardest core Democrats, had any doubt that there would be an election of 2004 and that it would be decided by normal means, which is a way of saying that Jackson's accomplishment, and by the way, he did win in 1828, and he did confirm the principle that democracy was the way politics in this country would be conducted. He was so successful, he and his successors were so successful in entrenching the idea of democracy that by 2000, we could just take it as a ho-hum, for granted aspect of the way business was done. So this is a case, and this would be, I guess, the overall theme that I would have identified in that preface that I didn't write. And that was that the reason for, if you ask me, the reason for the discrepancy between Jackson's modern reputation and Jackson's historic reputation is that we remember Jackson for his sins. We remember Jackson for those rough aspects of Jackson's policy, Jackson's temperament, which in fact are the rough edges of American democracy. Every one of those things I said about Jackson, slaveholder, militant expansionist, tough on the Indians, those were American policies. Those were the policies of American democracy. They make us a little bit uncomfortable, and to remember Jackson, we have to remember those. But Jackson's great accomplishments, the two things, by holding the Union together and confirming democracy, these are things that have become such an accepted part of American life. Nobody talks about secession today. There's no chance that Virginia is going to split away. There's no chance that, well, I live in Texas. There's some folks in West Texas who call themselves the Republic of Texas, and they dream about becoming, you know, there are crackpots in every state. But it's not a serious movement. And likewise, democracy is simply taken for granted. So in that respect, Jackson succeeded too well for his historical reputation. The things that he accomplished have become an essential part of American life so that we don't even think about them. And those other aspects that we do think about are things that were less essential to Jackson's historic reputation, but they are things that make us a little bit uncomfortable. I do have to say something about that other time that Jackson saved the Union, because I promised that he saved the Union once on the battlefield and once when he was president, and that was in his conflict with South Carolina. In the 1832 and 1833, South Carolina had a gripe against the federal government, and the gripe centered on a tax bill, a tax increase. It was a tariff bill. The South Carolinians and other Southerners called it the Tariff of Abominations. Good label. And it certainly conveyed their interpretation of it. It overstated things considerably. They were really arguing about a few pennies on the dollar. But to the South Carolinians, this was emblematic of the fact that the federal government was too large and was overreaching. The South Carolinians passed an ordinance of nullification. In fact, unbeknownst originally to Jackson, it had been drafted by his vice president, John Calhoun. When Jackson found out, Calhoun was no longer vice president. But The South Carolinians passed this ordinance of nullification, which forbade the enforcement of this federal law in South Carolina. And behind the ordinance of nullification was the threat of secession. If the feds tried to enforce the law, then South Carolina would secede from the Union. Andrew Jackson, as I said, was a stout states' rights man, but it was within the realm of the Union. Andrew Jackson was a Southern Unionist. You could call him a states' rights unionist. States' rights in most things, but the Union has to remain supreme because, and here's another theme that I would have identified in the preface. For Andrew Jackson's generation, for every generation up through Jackson's, including until the Civil War, the outcome of the American experiment in self-government was by no means assured. Jackson and his contemporaries believed it had to be fought for every year. Sometimes on the battlefield, as against the British, sometimes politically, as against those South Carolina secessionists. And Jackson believed that once the Union split over the tariff, the whole thing would fall apart, and that government by the people would be endangered. So Jackson's devotion to the Union had less to do with any interpretation of the Constitution or what happened at Philadelphia in 1787, less to do with that than with the necessity of defending the Union against its enemies, foreign and domestic. Jackson responded to the South Carolina challenge by ordering his Secretary of War to prepare an army, as many as 200,000 troops, that Jackson proposed to lead personally into South Carolina to suppress any rebellion. A South Carolina congressman visited the White House on his way home for the Christmas holidays, at the moment the crisis reached ahead, and asked Jackson, asked the president if he had any message for his constituents. And Jackson said, "Yes, I do. Please tell my friends in South Carolina." Jackson was a native South Carolinian. "Please tell my friends in South Carolina that if any of them breathes a word of secession, I will come down there and hang every secessionist from the highest tree I can find." When Andrew Jackson, the hero of New Orleans, spoke that way, when Andrew Jackson, an experienced duelist, the only president, by the way, to have killed a man in cold blood in a duel, the man insulted his wife. And there are many people in Jackson's day and age who thought that that showed that Jackson was a violent brawler. Those people didn't vote for Jackson. The larger number who did vote for Jackson thoroughly agreed with him that the man deserved killing. So it was a mark in Jackson's favor among those people who sided with Jackson. Anyway, when Jackson told South Carolina that secession meant war, a war in which they were going to be crushed, well, the South Carolinians decided to think again. They backed down. If not for Jackson at that moment, the Union almost certainly would have it certainly would have been endangered. It might well have fallen apart. And every man and woman, every politically aware person of Jackson's generation understood what had happened, that this president had held the country together at its moment of greatest challenge. And that's what Jackson was remembered for. Now, I have spoken longer than I intended to. I wanted to leave more time for questions, so I will stop, and I will try to answer any questions that you might have.
Sir, yes, sir. Right in the back.
Just a point of clarification, you said that you talked about enfranchisement, that it was white men that could vote. What about freedmen at that point of color? Were they allowed to vote or not?
In some states they were. The rules on voting were entirely state by state. And free African Americans were allowed to vote in some places, in other places not. Actually, I can't remember if by the 1820s and 1830s, women were still voting. Women had voted in some of the states at a certain point. They lost the vote in some places. I don't remember what the exact status was. But voting was a state-by-state arrangement.
Here we go.
Why was it a state arrangement? You said that it wasn't in the Constitution. Did they ever think of making it an amendment?
Regarding voting for president?
Right.
I don't know if anybody proposed that. Well, actually, what I do know is that Andrew Jackson, who had suffered in 1824 by the fact that there were these electors and all. What Jackson proposed was an amendment that would choose a president by direct popular vote. Now, whether that would have directly infringed, I don't remember the details of that, whether, I guess that would have pretty much directly enfranchised everybody, yeah. But it didn't catch on, and the amendment was never written.
You mentioned the difficulties that Jackson or anybody else would have had in raising an army, either chasing down the Indians or confronting the British, and described the sort of ragtag group. Could you explain a little bit more about, wasn't there a kind of a reward, because the pay wasn't exactly great, in fact they often couldn't even come up with food as you described it. Wasn't there this sort of this bonus, so to speak, that if you were on the succeeding side in some of these battles, at least as a white man, you could get 160 acres or some amount of land? And how did that work in terms of, did the freed blacks, were they offered some of that land? And what about the Indians? Were there bonuses of some kind that were offered to these groups that created incentives for them to join up with him?
The bounties that were offered to soldiers depended entirely on the war, on the generosity or mood of Congress, on the attitudes of the state legislatures when they raised the militia. I'm trying to remember what the compensation package was during the War of 1812. I think it was mostly cash. Sam Houston, for example, served under Jackson at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend and Jackson's campaign in the Creek War. But he was a member of the regular U.S. Army, and he was paid cash. I don't believe, but I could be wrong about this, I don't believe that during the War of 1812, land was much used as a way of compensating soldiers. I know it was used during the Revolutionary War, and I know definitely that it was used by Houston when he went to Texas as a way of recruiting soldiers for the Texas Army. In terms of compensation for African Americans, I'm assuming that they qualified for land during the Revolutionary War because they got paid like everybody else. Presumably they would get land along with everybody else. As I say, I don't think that compensation was used during the War of 1812, so presumably it wouldn't have applied.
Question from someone in the overflow room. What about Jackson's alleged role in the Burr conspiracy? Is that part of your indictment against him?
Well, it's not part of my indictment, and it would be a part of an indictment, a modern indictment, against Jackson, except that almost nobody can remember, in our day and age, can remember what the Burr conspiracy was about, in part because nobody at the time knew what the Burr conspiracy was about. I do deal with it in the book. Andrew Jackson was friends with Aaron Burr. Andrew Jackson admired Aaron Burr as a good Republican. Today's Democrats were called Republicans, and actually had a sneaking admiration for Burr as well for killing that arch Federalist, Alexander Hamilton. When after Burr killed Hamilton in the duel in New Jersey and had to flee to the West, he stopped twice at Jackson's home in Nashville, and Jackson showed him every hospitality. Burr was sophisticated, intelligent, spoke a really good game, and talked about how the Western territories, including Tennessee, needed greater access to the outlet of the Mississippi at New Orleans. Now, Burr didn't share with Jackson exactly what he had in mind. It's unclear until today exactly what Burr had in mind. Presumably, and this is what Burr was charged with eventually in his treason trial, he was charged with conspiring to separate, to detach the Western territories from the United States and either set them up as an independent republic, kingdom, whatever, depending on how nefarious you thought Burr was, or attaching them to Spain's dominions, because Burr had spoken with Spanish authorities at New Orleans. Jackson at first didn't understand what Burr was up to. When it became clear that Burr was up to no good, then Jackson found himself in a very embarrassing, compromising position, and he backpedaled furiously, although he later came to believe that Burr was made a scapegoat for a larger conspiracy that included James Wilkinson, who was the governor at New Orleans, and whom Jackson thought was as deeply involved in the affair as Burr himself was. So it was an episode that cast no favorable light on Jackson's judgment of men. And it, in that regard, it was very embarrassing to him because he did consider himself to be a good judge of men.
We have time for one more question, Dr. Hunt.
You seem to go along with what I call the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer John Wayne concept of bullet removal. In every movie that John Wayne was in, a bullet was usually removed after enormous probing, and then it was thrown into a tin pan that you could hear clang. Probably why Lincoln died quickly. His head was probed going after the bullet. Modern medicine leaves the bullet alone, just as they did for Jackson. You seem to go along with the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer John Wayne concept.
I'm not sure exactly what the question is here.
You seem to think that it was that they should have gone in to remove it because the lead would be eluded
out. Okay. I was reaching for a larger metaphor. In the narrow terms of what do you do with the bullets? Jackson carried at least 3 bullet fragments in his body, one from the duel which he fought in which he killed a man named Charles Dickinson. And if I have a moment, I just have to share with you what really I thought was utterly fascinating. And it was what you could call the theory of dueling. And there were at least 2 different approaches to dueling, because the duels were nothing like the quick draw contests of the American West. These were duels where 2 men faced each other with smoothbore pistols at a distance of about 20 to 30 feet, 8 to 10 paces. And at the order of one of the seconds, fire. You had your choice. You could fire right away, or you could wait a little bit and let your opponent fire first. If you were a good shot and you had great confidence in your ability to kill your opponent with a quick shot, then you would fire first. But for that to work, you had to hit the opponent in the brain or in the heart, because anything less than that would allow the opponent to get off a shot. Andrew Jackson did not consider himself a particular marksman with a pistol. And so in his duel, and Jackson was one of those people, when he was mildly angry, somewhat annoyed, he would scream and shout. But when he got really angry, he all of a sudden got very quiet. And in this argument that he had with Charles Dickinson, he was screaming and shouting for a while, and then Dickinson uttered the name of Rachel in a tone that conveyed somewhat less than respect. So Jackson got very quiet, and it was that point that Dickinson's doom was sealed. There was going to be a duel. There was no way around it. And in this duel, Jackson adopted the second philosophy of dueling, which is accept, take the shot, take the hit from the other person, and then stand your ground and take your aim very carefully. And if you're the second shooter, then you don't have to be such a good shot. You don't have to hit him in the brain. You don't have to hit him in the heart. In fact, better to aim for the gut, because then your opponent will either bleed out and die within a matter of 20 minutes or so, or suffer infection and die very painfully 2 days later. But there's a much greater chance of actually killing your opponent. So they meet early in the morning, and Jackson's opponent, confident in his ability, fires and aims at Jackson's heart and misses Jackson's heart by 1/2 inch. In part because it was a cool morning, it was a little bit windy, and Jackson was wearing this kind of loose overcoat. Jackson was also very skinny, and it was kind of hard to tell exactly where his heart was. So, fate, some people wonder whether he had one. But the bullet missed his heart. Jackson sort of checked long enough to realize, okay, I'm still alive here. In fact, he was so determined, so resolute, that at first neither his opponent nor the 2 seconds realized that he had been hit. And they thought, oh my gosh, this other guy missed, which was amazing because he's a very good shot. Well, he had very nearly killed Jackson. At that point, Jackson leveled the gun, took clear aim, pulled the trigger, and nothing happened. Now, in the theory and practice of dueling, a misfire counted as a shot if the hammer came down and it didn't ignite the bullet. then that counted as a shot, game over. But there was sort of an exception to the exception, an exclusion to the exception, that if the hammer didn't go all the way down, then it counted not as a misfire, but a missed cock. And with a missed cock, you got to cock it over again. So Jackson checked with the 2 seconds. They said, yeah, you can do it. You know, Charles Dickens is standing there, you know, sweating bullets. And very slowly, Jackson, you know, pulls back the hammer again. And, you know, at this point, one, you know, the author, realizing that he's having a modern sensibility, you know, sort of wants Jackson, come on, okay, you've proved your point, now relent. No. He very calmly pulls it back, bang. Hits the guy in the intestines, he dies 6 hours later. So, oh, but as a result of this, Jackson, I was trying to remember what this was apropos of, Jackson carried this bullet around in his chest for the rest of his life. He also got in a shooting scrape, not quite a duel, but just bang, 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 where everybody was shooting and stabbing each other with knives, with Thomas Hart Benton and his brother Jesse. And Jackson took a couple of bullets in the shoulder, which essentially incapacitated him just at the time when the Creek War was breaking out and he was needed. And he left those bullets in, either he did or his surgeons did, partly because Jackson wouldn't let them get anywhere near him because he was afraid they were going to amputate his arm. And even though he was half delirious, he made very clear that if they amputated the arm, he was coming after their arms. So they left it on, but for the rest of his life, Jackson had these lead fragments in his body. And what shall I call them, forensic historians or medical historians, have conjectured over the years what effect this had on his health. These bullet fragments almost certainly leached lead out into his bloodstream, and that was not good for his health. But it probably was less bad for his health than the medicines that he was taking, because two of the medicines of choice during those days were sugar of lead, which was a compound of lead that was used, sometimes it was taken internally, you simply drink it. Sometimes you would use it, Jackson would use it to, he had eye irritation, so he'd bathe his eyes in it. He had various skin maladies, and so he'd just swab it on. He also took various forms of mercury. And so here he was, he's basically swimming in heavy metals. And people knew sometimes what the consequences of these were. I guess it was the mercury that caused people to salivate excessively. But this was an occupational hazard. I mean, like a side effect for any medicine you took. It just is a reminder of how difficult life could be. And people in the early 19th century, people until almost till our day and age, didn't labor under any illusions that health was supposed to be 100%. If you were alive, that was good enough. Jackson hung on for 78 years, and that was a good long life. Thank you very much.